This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome Richard Luthi. He's professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Stanford University. He's senior fellow in the Woods Institute for the Environment. He's the director of an organization called Renew It, which we will talk about what that means and what that stands for in a moment. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
So let's talk about our nation's current urban water infrastructure. We have had a lot of interest in the question of water in cities. It's not, in many places, it is not a new infrastructure, and in some places it's sort of falling apart. Like, where are we at? What are some of the problems that we're looking at?
Well, you're exactly right. The urban water infrastructure that we have today was built largely more than 50 years ago, often maybe 100 years ago. And so what's happened over time is the current infrastructure we have in place, which provides water for a functioning city and a functioning economy, protects public health, and the wastewater treatment systems that contribute to having a good and healthy environment in a city. These systems were built quite a long time ago. The last major construction activity was with the passage of the Clean Water Act in 1972, in which the federal government paid a lot to upgrade sewers and wastewater treatment plants. But there's been no substantial investment since then. So here we are today, and these systems are at the end of their design life. And that's a story that's true all across the United States. But out here in the West, we have these other difficulties. One of them is the fact that our population is growing. And so we have greater need for water as people are moving to what you might call the dry Sun Belt. You're from Santa Fe, and you know people are moving to Santa Fe and Albuquerque and the like, and Phoenix and L.A., the Bay Area. Well, these are all places that can only exist because of imported water. So with more and more people coming, there's a greater need for water. At the same time, we have this struggle with other needs for our water than just for cities. Historically, the other great need has been water for agriculture. But today we realize we also have to leave water for ecosystems. So back in the time when I was in graduate school in the early 1970s, the Clean Water Act was just passed. Basically, that act said, you can't poison the fish. It didn't say you can't take all their water.
Right.
And you say, what kind of a deal is that? Well, that's not much of a deal if you're a fish.
It probably never occurred to them that we could take out that much water.
Well, it's also the limits of what you're legislating. And you were legislating for clean discharges. You weren't legislating for water use. But what happened over time is that with cities growing and agricultural use, then rivers get depleted. Now today, we recognize that we can't take all the water. We have to leave water for ecosystems. Now, in a place like California, that brings a whole nother stress to our water use. The cities have been growing. We have a very large agricultural industry in the state. And the two together basically take all the water. But now you'd say, well, we got to leave some now to have flowing water in our rivers and streams. And importantly, through what we call the Bay Delta. That's where the San Joaquin and the Sacramento River meet, and then that water goes out to the bay. That's like a water hub that's dependent upon fresh water flowing through that system to make sure it's fresh, and also it sustains certain endangered species. So these are the pressures we feel, and then if that weren't enough, you have climate change on top of it. And climate change for us means two things: that we'll have more severe droughts. Droughts are a recurring thing. And secondly, that our precipitation will come more as rain in the mountains rather than snow. Snow for us in California, like maybe also in Santa Fe, it's kind of like having water in the bank, sort of having water in a dam, but you don't have a dam. It's just snow. So in California, in very late spring, in June, the snow melts. Well, when the snow melts, you can collect that water behind all your dams because it's not going to rain anymore. So you don't have to worry about flood protection. Early in the winter, we keep the reservoirs kind of low because you want to provide flood protection. And you let the snow pile up. Later, rain stop, snow melts, fill up your reservoirs. Well, this becomes more of a challenge when there's less snow and more rain. So it's all of these factors then that have sort of come together that bring a greater criticality and a different set of issues to our urban water infrastructure challenges than you would have in other parts of the country.
Let's talk for a moment about the importance of keeping water in ecosystems. I mean, it's not just about having beautiful rivers that we can go out and make paintings. I mean, there's something that people call ecosystem services. It's very important on many levels.
Well, that's true. There are people, and I think this is right, that you do value scenic landscapes. Just a moment ago, we were talking about, before we started recording, about the open space here. And everyone values that and says, what a treasure it is that we have it. Well, the same thing goes for having rivers that flow and maintaining the riparian corridors and the like. That's very important. But also it's important to maintain the aquatic species. And if the rivers dry up, and if they're not intended to dry up, like the Sacramento would normally kind of flow all year, then you need to sustain that flow. It helps not only for the fish in the river, but also it keeps this Bay Delta area fresh rather than saline. That's important for ecosystems. It's also important for the way the water kind of meanders its way through this Bay Delta and finds its way into the California aqueduct. We want fresh water, not salty water. So if there were no rivers, no water flowing, we'd have a saltier delta.
You are the director of an organization called Renew It, and that's an acronym for Reinventing the Nation's Urban Water Infrastructure. And one of the things that you're working on, well, I want to hear like what the organization is about, but one of the things you're working on, which is interesting to me, is natural water infrastructure systems. What does that mean?
Right. Well, we tend to think of our urban water infrastructure as tanks and pipes and pumps. But another area that we can look at is the ability of natural systems to function as more reliable components of our urban water infrastructure. One example could be wetland systems that can help purify water as water flows through it. It creates urban amenities. It creates habitat. They're scenic and nice to have. We just don't know how they perform in terms of water quality improvement. So one of the areas in which we're studying is how to better understand the way that we could design and manage wetlands to provide reliable water quality improvement as the water flows through it. Another sort of natural system you could think of would be a system that would capture stormwater and then infiltrate it into the subsurface in the urban environment and use subsurface aquifers as storage for our water.
So that what that means, if I understand correctly, is when rain falls on cities, you look at where it goes and you try to make it go into a good place.
Right. And the cities in California are a really good example of this. Between the Bay Area, Los Angeles, Orange County, you've seen pictures of what, or you've probably driven through these areas. Imagine Los Angeles. It looks like a bunch of concrete and asphalt. It used not to be that way. You didn't have this hardscape. So what happens today is that rainfall falls on the city, and it runs off. And it will create more runoff than there would normally be because the ground isn't permeable.
Meaning the asphalt and the...
Yeah, the asphalt and concrete and the freeways and the like. And the roofs of buildings. All of that means that you have more hardscape and less sponge, if you want to think of it that way. So the way systems evolved over time was to solve that problem as a flood control problem, which meant building channels that would convey that water to the ocean or to a bay as quick as you can. And so we're left today with these iconic stormwater channels in L.A. You've seen them in all the action movies. You remember Terminator is one. Actually, I can list quite a few of these movies that have chase scenes in those concrete channels. They're great for an action movie, but they're not so great for as an urban amenity. So they serve their function of preventing flooding. But now here we are today with all those urban water challenges I've just described, and we look at that and think, well, my goodness, this is storm water that's going to the ocean. We should capture that and use it.
Yeah, because that's fresh water.
Yes, yeah. It's fresh water. It's not salty water. It's rainwater. Now, it's not squeaky clean because it's run through this urban hardscape. I mean, it's not sewage either. You know, it just needs to be cleaned up a little bit. But the point is that if we could capture and hold that water, then that's a new water supply, and that will help reduce our dependency on imported water. And it's the imported water where there's a lot of uncertainty in the future for all the things that I just said. And here in California, for these big cities, there's no one else that is a claimant on that water. In Santa Fe, if you were to collect all your water, then the people in all your stormwater runoff, if you were to collect it all, every bit of it, then the people in Albuquerque might wonder, where's my water? And then the people in Las Cruces, if Albuquerque did that, they'd say, what happened to our water? So in inland areas, it's become more challenging with water rights. But here, because the water goes from the city to the ocean, there isn't a water right issue. There's an opportunity for us. But how you actually do this, how you build this out in ways that will make a difference, and in ways that don't exacerbate the flooding problem, and in ways in which you treat that stormwater before you recharge it so you don't contaminate groundwater, these are things to be worked out. But we see a great opportunity here. And so we're seeing stormwater today as an opportunity, not as a flood control problem.
But, I mean, how are you doing it? What have you got so far?
Well, we're not the only ones working on this, and cities like Los Angeles and others have been looking at what would be the opportunity to try to capture that water. And it depends on having a place where you could put in a capture facility, and this would look like a pond maybe or something like that. And you got to be near a place where you could put that water. In other words, you have to have the right geology to infiltrate it into the ground. So if you could imagine Los Angeles, the land near the ocean is fairly clay-like, and it's not good for water infiltration. But if you, as you go east and north from downtown, you find places where you can infiltrate that water. This would be in the areas where this Los Angeles River and the Santa Ana River flowed at one time. So you have a subsurface that's more gravelly and sandy. And those are good places to put the stormwater. So what we would be looking at then would be larger scale systems where you could create like a pond-like feature with a wetland to help capture then treat that water, then run it through some filters to clean it up further, and then put it in the ground. Some of the systems we might envision would be a smaller scale. They might be neighborhood scale, where you do things on the scale of a city block or a few city blocks. Those are important, too, because that engages the public. It helps green the streets, and it shows that we're not just putting everything in large systems, that small systems scattered throughout a city are important, too.
When you say green the streets, like, what would that look like?
I would have to point you to a street called Elmer Avenue, E-L-M-E-R, two blocks in Los Angeles in the Sun Valley neighborhood. When this area was developed a long time ago, the ground was so permeable that the developers got away with saying, you know, we don't need storm sewers here because all this ground is so permeable. Well, that's true, but there was a little bit of a falsehood there. When the whole place got built up, it wasn't permeable anymore. So it was an area that was prone to constant flooding. So imagine a street that floods periodically, that has no sidewalks, that has no curbs, that cars kind of park sort of on the edge of the street or kind of in the front yard a bit. But frankly, it looks a little scruffy. Now, imagine taking that street, building some vegetated swales on either side of the street, put in sidewalks, redesign the street so the water flows to those swales, and capture that water, and then put it in a common pipe, and then have it recharge the ground, the groundwater put into the ground. You end up with a street now that now has sidewalks and curbs and has been landscaped. It looks quite nice. You would have to look at these before and after pictures. That they're very dramatic, actually. Now, that's expensive to do, but it's important to do things like that because it shows what's possible.
It's expensive in the short run. Does it save money in the long run?
Well, yes, it does. The larger systems are more cost-effective and are likely to make a bigger difference in terms of the amount of water that's captured and used to recharge urban aquifers. But you need both. When we talk about expense here, who's paying the bills? It's the public. So you think, well, we need to do some things that improve neighborhoods where we can. We also need to do these larger systems that when they're built, we want them to look more like a park. I've told my wife about this, and one time she said, are you talking about a mud hole? And I said, no, it's not. And she said, well, you mean swamp, and you need your waders to go study it. No, it's not that. This would look like a park. It will have a basketball court, a tot lot, that kind of thing. It'll have a walking trail. There'll be lots of trees. But it'll also have something that looks like a pond and another thing that looks like a wetland. Now, those are the pond and the wetland are there to help capture and treat the stormwater. After the wetland, the water may flow through a series of filters that help provide additional purification. But the whole system, when it's all done, would look like a nice feature. It won't look industrial. It won't be a place that will collect flies and the like. It'll be a place where people go and walk around and play. And in the example that I'm referring to here is one that I'm quite familiar with, is a plan to take a 50-acre dump in the Sun Valley neighborhood of Los Angeles, a former quarry, gravel quarry, that then what became a place where people would dump concrete and asphalt, clean all that up and convert it to this wetland and park-like feature, all the time serving another purpose to collect, treat, and recharge stormwater. And the amount of water that you would collect and treat here can be fairly large. It might be 900 acre-feet a year. Now, that's a lot of water. So this is a great thing to work on, and it's fun because you're taking water that's otherwise would be wasted. You're taking storm water that otherwise would run to the ocean and probably carry a lot of trash with it and pollute the beach. You're coming up with a solution that is providing a park in a neighborhood that doesn't have many parks. And along the way, you're taking what was a gravel pit and dump and making it a green feature with trees and grasses and stuff like that.
And you're kind of working the way nature works, the way watersheds work, the way wetlands work before humans started interfering and making cities in the first place?
Well, the idea is, right, is I think I used the example a minute ago of you want the city to be more like a sponge. That's what it was before. You would have rainfall. It wouldn't run off so quick. Some of it would percolate into the ground. And if some did run off, it would seep off slowly. And you wouldn't have a flash flood, but it's a challenge to think about. Okay, how do we build such systems? How do we make sure that they work reliably and the like? But there's a lot of excitement for these kinds of projects, and we have support, as I mentioned, from the groups in Los Angeles that want to see this come into being, and we do too. So stormwater capture, it's one of the ways in which we can take the water we have today and make it become part of our water supply in the future. And what that does for us, it reduces the need to import water, and that means that we are better equipped to get through a drought. It also means that we are leaving water for other purposes, and that can be for ecosystems or it can be for agriculture.
When you say import water, what do you mean?
Well, in California, the big cities would not exist except for taking water from 100 or more miles away and bringing it to the cities. Where we are here at Stanford, our water comes from Yosemite National Park. That's the watershed, and that is snowmelt. That's collected in reservoirs and comes to an aqueduct to us. In Los Angeles, you have the Los Angeles Aqueduct. You also have the California Aqueduct that takes water from Northern California to Southern California. And you have the Colorado River Aqueduct that crosses the Mojave Desert and brings water to Los Angeles, Orange County, and San Diego. So San Francisco Bay Area, Los Angeles, Orange County, San Diego, none of these cities could exist without importing water.
Do you have numbers on how much you could reduce that imported water through the methods you're talking about?
Well, yes. A good example is to look at the city of Los Angeles. And their plans are over the next 20 years are to reduce the amount of water that they import by half.
Wow.
Now, that's a big change. Even in the face of population growth, in real numbers, reduce it by half. And so that other water is a combination of conservation, stormwater capture, more recycled water, and rehabilitating a groundwater basin.
There's another thing I wanted to ask you. One of the problems that people talk about in New Mexico and all kinds of places when they talk about water treatment is the problem of pharmaceuticals in the water. We human beings seem to take so many drugs and so many medicines, and a lot of the molecules of the residue after that goes through our bodies ends up in our wastewater, and they're hard to filter out. They can create all kinds of problems. What are some of the innovations for addressing that problem of pharmaceuticals in wastewater?
Well, this is a problem that has the attention of the public for sure. You're quite correct in saying the cause of it is not one single thing. It's all of us collectively just using a lot of medications. And this goes from things like ibuprofen that you might take every day to other drugs that are prescription drugs. So the occurrence of these chemicals are found in wastewater. They're not particularly well removed in wastewater treatment. And that means that they find their way into the discharges from wastewater treatment. The wastewater treatment plants weren't designed to remove these chemicals. So there's a challenge there. But when those chemicals get into the environment, they're really quite dilute. Where there's a question is if you want to reuse that water and make it become part of your potable water supply, then just think, wait a second here, I'm bringing those drugs maybe back into my water supply. So for that, you want to make sure you have additional treatment to make sure that those chemicals are removed.
So that I'm not drinking somebody else's Xanax.
Yeah, that'd be one way of describing it. In fact, you would have to drink an awful lot of water to get a therapeutic dose. You couldn't even drink that much water. But it's still an issue. It's one that needs to be addressed and one that the public's concerned about. So what are some good ways that you can help reduce these chemicals? I described wetlands. Oftentimes, wetlands are highly vegetated. But if you say, well, let's think of a different wetland that's more like a pond, a shallow pond, then sunlight can help break down some of these chemicals just by natural processes, kind of like sunlight will bleach out your clothes, you know, or whatever. Will give you a suntan. Same thing happens with some pharmaceuticals in water. So that's one way. Another one is we've been studying here at Stanford the way in which we might reclaim water on the campus for non-potable use. And this system that we're studying relies on a different consortia of microbes to treat the water. Instead of adding oxygen to the water and aerating it, you eliminate oxygen and you let bacteria thrive that can grow without oxygen. And what they do is they end up converting a lot of the organic matter to methane. You can capture that methane, get energy from the process, and help use that energy to run your waste, your water recovery system. At the same time, that system seems to do a really good job of removing pharmaceuticals, essentially removing them all. Now, why those organisms can do it, you know, it's something that needs to be studied, but the evidence we have is that these so-called anaerobic processes are much more efficient than the aerobic processes. So maybe we've actually, maybe we're on the way to help solve that problem as we also think about new ways of recycling water.
A lot of people are working on and talking about and promoting urban agriculture. Do we have calculations of how much water it would take for a city to grow enough food on, you know, rooftops and urban gardens to feed itself? I mean, feed 1% of its population, half of its population? What are we looking at?
I don't have a number off the top of my head, but I'm a gardener, and I think gardening is healthy exercise. It's fine if you want to grow your own food. We grow lemons and oranges and figs and cherries. You know, that's what I have. And I struggle with grapes, but sometimes I have a good crop, sometimes not. But, you know, that sort of thing I find can be used to beautify the landscaping around a house. You don't have to have grass. Citrus trees, for example, in this area, figs are another one, olives another one. These are trees that can grow in a Mediterranean climate. They're not water intensive, and you can get some fruit from them. But to think that in the urban environment we would all grow our food for ourselves, I think that's a bit of a stretch. But I do think it's healthy to have people that would like to have access to where they can garden. It's good for a family. It's good for educating young children. I think there are a lot of reasons to do it, but I'm not so sure about these things where you look where a building looks like it's got all these vegetables growing on its walls. You know, I think that's a little far-fetched. I look at that and say, all I can think of is problems, not the least of which is mold and mildew and maintenance and whatnot.
Right.
It just doesn't seem very feasible. But gardening, I think, is, and that there are probably lots, I guess maybe what I'm thinking of is that if you look around the city, there's probably a lot of vacant land or marginally used land that could go to be community gardens, and that's fine.
What are some... I'm sorry, go ahead.
So what do you think about that? Or what do you...
I have no idea. I mean, I interviewed a fellow who was in Detroit who was doing urban agriculture there, and it was like a social thing because there's a lot of people in Detroit who are very poor and who are also really alienated from the source of their food and are like in food deserts and eating really horrible food. And they were making these greenhouses that provided like a community agriculture that provided healthy food, and they were providing jobs for people, and they were providing a kind of a reconnection to their own community and to their own life force. I mean, it was a very healthy thing. And it's one of the questions that when you think about the whole question of sustainable agriculture, one of the things that I keep asking and that I have no idea what the answer is, but I mean, I guess...
When you went to Detroit, or did you go to Detroit?
No. I just read the book. I read the book that the guy had written about his thing.
Well, my wife's from Detroit.
Oh, okay.
So what do you have in Detroit? You have a hollowed-out city. I mean, basically, so much of the city was abandoned homes, fire traps, and the like. And then it was about all the city could do is just tear them down. They can't even tear them all down. But you'd say, well, look, what should you do with that? Well, clear off a lot of that land and convert that to gardens. And that's a great thing for all the reasons you just said. But that's Detroit. We're not talking downtown San Francisco.
Right.
You know. And I think there in Detroit, I would do the same. I would say, take that bunch of that land, create wide boulevards, create parks, create urban agriculture, and eventually the city will come back. But you'd want to have this repurposed land that now makes a much greener and open city.
The thing that I keep on coming back to is this question of, you know, whether we're talking about urban agriculture, whether we're talking about organic agriculture, is this, and it's maybe not something that you can answer, but it's just something that we keep coming back to, is organic agriculture, is urban agriculture like a little niche product that feeds a small percentage of people, or is it like a new way of life, a new way of actually getting our food?
Well, I think it's important for all of us to know how we're connected to the place in which we live, and that the place in which we live is connected to planet Earth, and that things like gardening help connect you back to the land. It makes you think about water and growing food. Maybe, I mean, you don't have to grow all your food, but growing something makes you aware of what it takes, the labor involved, the water involved, and like that. Make you more sensitive to not wasting food, or to think about not using foods that are highly water intensive, for example, or not eating foods that have to be shipped 5,000 miles from Chile in the winter or something like that. So I think all that's good. We were talking earlier about urban systems, and we didn't get to it, but I wanted to mention that there's a lot of places in California where you have cities right next to high-value agriculture. And a good example is down around Monterey, where at the bottom of the end of the Salinas Valley, where it opens up and gets near the ocean, their recycled water is used to irrigate about 12,000 acres of agricultural land. And this land produces celery, lettuce, cauliflower, broccoli, strawberries. Now, what's interesting about all those crops I just mentioned is they all can be eaten raw, and we're using recycled water on these crops. So part of what was done a long time ago to figure out how all this would work was how to make that be a safe process. But using that recycled water to irrigate those crops means that you don't have to pump the groundwater. And the problem with pumping groundwater is you were using it too fast, and you were starting to draw in salt water through the subsurface. And so we have sustainable agriculture now in Monterey that uses this recycled water, and you can grow crops almost all year round, you know, 300, maybe 330 days a year you can grow crops. And if you want to think about that area, just think of it as the party platter, and how much of this, for real.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like so much of the salad, the iceberg lettuce and the like, the strawberries, the celery, all comes from a kind of a small place in the country, but they produce a lot of food. And it's very, I've been down to some of these places where they, well, both in the fields and where they process this. These are big operations, and think, wow, this is what it takes to sort of feed a country, you know, to put that lettuce on your Whopper. Yeah, maybe you don't like Whoppers, but you know what I mean. Or your Olive Garden, or wherever, you know. That finds its way all across the country. And it comes from a place where we have good weather, good soil, and we're using recycled water to help sustain that agriculture.
So given all the things that you've been talking about, and I mean, we've seen over the course of, well, of the history of this country, vast changes, the growth of cities, and then the spread of diseases through our water systems, and then the invention of chlorination, and then massive pollution of waterways and oceans, and the overuse of rivers and underground aquifers, and all to feed, first of all, population growth, and then a real industrial consumer society that is very greedy. And sometimes I think about the way we live and the things we take for granted, and the idea that if we wanted to, we could eat sushi 5 days a week. I mean, we're living.
Yeah, you could.
You know, we could, and we're living better than Renaissance kings. You know, and I mean, given what you know about water, do you think we have to change the way we live in order to have a sustainable and healthy water system?
Well, I think we do, but I'd like to go back about 2,000 years ago, and this idea of importing water and moving it around a city, and then you have wastewater and you have to have a sewer and dispose of it. That's what the Romans did. And basically, what we've done is we've taken the systems the Roman used and put on a water treatment plant and a wastewater treatment plant. So you can think about phase one, Romans, phase two, early 20th century, phase three, mid to late 20th century. Now here we are in the 21st century, and we see that, well, we're going to have to change the way in which we manage and use and reuse our water. And all of us need to understand we're part of the problem, and we all have to have a stake in the outcome. We all have to do our part, so to speak. So when I look to the future, I see things like ever more water recycle, ever more stormwater capture, and continued conservation as ways of the future. But we've done a lot on conservation already. A big drought in California in the early 90s was what prompted a change to low-flow toilets. Now, it takes a while for all that to be, but every building now has low-flow toilets. And if you don't, your local water supplier will probably give you $200 or $300 to change it out. So these are things where we all have to work together. And when I said it's like we're all part of the problem, and we all have to be part of the solution. So it can't be like, Mary Charlotte, like you and I have a problem with water. And the answer to my problem is, Mary Charlotte, you're going to get less water. What kind of a deal is that? Well, that's no deal. We both have to work together. So I could be the city, you could be agriculture, Jane over here could be the fish. And I think, okay, we need to work this out, that all of us need to do our part, and we don't want to have groups or that have sort of special or favored status. And that could rub some people the wrong way. But I think ultimately Americans have a can-do attitude, and they also believe in fairness. And with good intentions and fairness as a guiding principle and we can do it attitude, we can solve our problems. But it takes a new mindset and a new reality. And I think in California, with the drought that we've had that's lasted for 4 years, it's like a wake-up call and say, okay, this is a new era for lots of different reasons. We're going to have to do something different. We can't muddle along like we have been for the last few decades.
Richard Luthi is professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Stanford University. He's a senior fellow in the Woods Institute for the Environment, and he's director of the organization Renew It. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Glad to do it.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.